Hey, it's me, Conspiracy Clown, cuz it's not enough our government are lying, murdering scum. So, I hear there's such a thing as the truth, and some people know what it is and where it is. And I hear this truth will set me free and arm me on the moral grassy knoll with awesome powers of a righteous Hey. The truth will out, and the truth can only be one thing, and the truth knows how I like my eggs in the morning. Let's just clarify something, though. We're not talking about when you run out of Rizla and you say, I've run out of Rizla. No, we're talking about big truth. Important, truthy truth. Life, the meaning of the universe, and everything, man. Who are we? What are we doing here? And where did all this stuff come from? Also, UFOs, Masons, Alien Reality Consciousness, JFK, RFK, the Great Pyramids, and Atlantis. Hey. You may not know the truth yet, but rest assured some intellectual or spiritual giant will be along shortly to remedy that. So, if you don't know the truth already, it's not too late. The truth has been waiting for you to wake up so you can enjoy it with a Coke. In fact, if you're short of truth at all, it can now be conveniently dispensed from blogs, online video, and ATMs using the top-up button. The truth about anything and everything is out there. What's that? You don't believe me? That's okay. It just means you're a New World Order government shill, moron, retard, sheep in the pay of COINTEL factions of the secret global secret secrecy. Hey. I have some news for you. The truth will never be agreed upon completely by any two people. Because everybody's different. Hey. Attempts to make people accept your truth make you a and anger directed towards people who don't share your delusion of the truth makes you a Hey. I just had an idea. Why don't we stop talking about the truth and sort out some facts we can all agree on? Then maybe we could deal with the that's happening on Earth. Nah, that would never work. Till next time, be well. Be happy, be free.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Thanksgiving is a lucky day for all the girls and boys. It isn't just like Christmas when your parents give you toys. It isn't even like Easter when you get an Easter bunny, or even like your birthday when your uncle sends you money. It isn't like the 4th of July or Decoration Day, or summer vacation or Halloween when all the kids can play. Thanksgiving is a different day, the day I like the best. It's even better than Sunday, which is called the Day of Rest. Thanksgiving is my favorite day, though the skies are gray and murky. 'Cause that's the day when I get to eat the drumstick of a turkey.
Here's a tweet from @Kirkamunga saying, "What is the most important thing to remember when talking to people who may not be as informed as you?" I love this question, Kirkamunga. There are three simple steps to dealing with uninformed people. First, when you realize that someone doesn't know something, repeat very loudly in their face the thing they don't know. For example, "You don't know who the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe is?" Second, look to everyone around you and let them know that this person is completely ignorant. "Hey everyone, Sebastian doesn't know who the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe is." Third, you call up the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe and tell him that Sebastian doesn't know who he is, and then laugh really loudly until the ignorant person just leaves in utter shame.
Here's to the state of Richard Nixon. For underneath his borders, the devil draws no line. If you drag his muddy rivers, nameless bodies you will find. And the fat trees of the forest have been 1,000 crimes. And the calendar's lying when it reads the present time. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the schools of Richard Nixon, where they're teaching all the children that they don't have to care. All the rudiments of hatred are present everywhere. And every single classroom is a factory of despair. Oh, there's nobody learning such a foreign word as fair. Oh, here's to the land you torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of.
How is it possible for you to have this kind of investment when all you earn was $800,000 as president? Well, I should point out, I wasn't a pauper when I became president. I wasn't very rich, as presidents go. But you see, when the 8 years that I was out of office, first, just to put it all out, and I'll give you a paper on this, we'll send it around to you, these figures I'd like for you to have. Not today, but I'll have it in a few days. When I left office after 4 years as a congressman, 2 years as a senator, and 8 years of $45,000 a year as vice president, and after stories had been written, particularly in the Washington Post, to the effect that the president had purchased a mansion in Wesley Heights and people wondered where the money came, you know what my net worth was? $47,000 total after 14 years of government service and a 1958 Oldsmobile that needed an overhaul. Now, I have no complaints. In the next 8 years, I made a lot of money. I made $250,000 from a book and the serial rights, which many of you were good enough to purchase also. In the practice of law, and I'm not claiming I was worth it, but apparently former vice presidents or presidents are worth a great deal to law firms, and I did work pretty hard. But in also in that period, I earned between $100,000 and $250,000 every year. So that when I, in 1968, decided to become a candidate for president, I decided to clean the decks and to put everything in real estate. I sold all my stock for $300,000. That's all I own. I sold my apartment in New York for $300,000. I'm using rough figures here. And I had $100,000 coming to me from the law firm. And so that's where the money came from. Let me just say this. And I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes. But in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
And here's to the laws of Richard Nixon. Where the wars are fought in secret, Pearl Harbor every day. He punishes with income tax that he don't have to pay. And he's tapping his own brother just to hear what he would say. But corruption can be classic in the Richard Nixon way. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the churches of Richard Nixon and Billy Graham. Where the cross once made of silver now is caked with rust. And the Sunday morning sermons pander to their lust. All the fallen face of Jesus is choking in the dust. And heaven only knows in which God they can trust. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the government of Richard Nixon. In the swamp of their bureaucracy, they're always bogging down. And criminals are posing as advisors to the crown. And they hope that no one sees the sights and no one hears the sound. And the speeches of the president are the ravings of a clown. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of.
But as our own Samantha Bee reports from a visit to Zuccotti Park on the occupation's final day, the movement was already being threatened by forces even more powerful than the city of New York. The prospect of becoming the very thing that they were fighting against.
Occupy Wall Street. It was born out of the loftiest of ambitions. We're trying to build a new society.
We're all equal and civilized with each other.
An open, horizontal, leaderless process.
And two nights ago, the occupation ended. But maybe it was a good thing. As it dragged on, the movement had been in danger of becoming the very thing it was fighting against.
The more people that came, the more people kind of like segregated into like their own little groups. The park kind of just split in half.
Up there is like where the college hipsters that live in Brooklyn go and try to rule the park from, you know, and down here it's more of the poor people's encampment, and that it's kind of contentious.
Occupy Wall Street was divided by class. On the one side, the elites with their library, Apple pop-up store, and bike-powered espresso machines. On the other, the downwardly mobile with their drum circles.
This is the ghetto.
And then what do you call it up top?
That's more of like the aristocratic side, like the Upper East Side.
Okay.
You have, you know, the West Enders and the East Enders.
They're just kind of making decisions without the general consensus of everybody in the park.
So let me get this straight. Yes. You've been here for 8 weeks and you already have a ghetto.
Well, I mean,
I headed uptown to see how the upper crust felt living next to the ghetto people.
What's the deal with down there?
They're also members of our society.
I think in any community, whether it be city, whether it be Zuccotti Park, you have areas that are a little quieter, areas that are a little louder.
Your political correctness is, you're just blowing up like a helium balloon. You're trying so hard not to say it.
Areas of our park that are inhabited by perhaps younger, more boisterous, energetic people.
Is there a course in condescension that everyone is taking here? Has a good idea ever come out of the bottom half of the park?
I think they do. On occasion, without them even knowing how good their ideas are, sometimes they come up with good ideas.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you give me an example of that?
That would probably be hard.
I headed back downtown to see how the moocher class defended itself.
How many hours of work did you put in today?
Hours of work have I put in today?
Yeah.
I'm not sure yet.
Have you put in any hours of work today?
I don't keep track of time while I'm here.
What percentage of the 99% are those Ivy League ass uptown?
I would say like 15.
15% of the park?
15, yeah.
Elitist? Yeah.
Yeah, but when everything comes down and it gets scary and everybody doesn't know what to do, what do? They call on us. Oh, could you help us out?
But perhaps the ghetto people didn't understand how hard the 15% of the 99% was working for them.
I'm here fighting for society where everyone has access to the goods of life.
Would you share your iPad too with one of those shiftless hobos down in Bumtown?
No, but I do think we should live in a society where everyone has access to technology and goods that everyone can use.
So it's not so much about sharing, it's about everybody having an iPad too.
Or at least everybody having access to the material wealth of life.
Okay,
not just a few people.
Except for yours.
Well, it's a personal possession. I'm more against private property, not personal property.
Clearly, it would be difficult to accomplish their goals in this contentious environment. Fortunately, they had a solution.
This is the space where our various committees and action groups meet to discuss the things they're working on and to develop proposals for the General Assembly.
Where are we?
We are at 60 Wall Street. Yeah, we're in the lobby of the Deutsche Bank building.
Holy sh!
Okay, I'm sorry. So the big decisions about Occupy Wall Street are being made in the atrium of the Deutsche Bank building.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. Is my nose bleeding?
No. Just, it looks good.
Because I feel like an aneurysm just exploded in my head.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense. Here, decisions could be made quietly and out of the sight of the masses.
Okay. Does the drum circle know that we're all here right now?
In any case, both the uptown elitists and the downtown poors can agree. The occupation ended too early. They didn't even have time to develop a middle class for this new society to crush.
On the mic and say, this your one song. groups in New York have evicted protesters with the Occupy Wall Street movement from the park in the city's financial district, where they've been camped since September. In footage filmed by the demonstrators, police wearing helmets and carrying shields are seen clashing with those they're trying to evict.
What are you arresting him for? He was trying to get out of the sidewalk and you threw him in the street.
It comes after authorities declared that the continued occupation of Zuccotti Park, which has become a sea of tents, poses a health and safety threat. A police spokesman said that while most left voluntarily, about 70 protesters were arrested during the operation.
They're taking the park, they're surrounding the park in riot gear. They're taking it and they're trying to block up every street right now. They're lining up to surround us.
The city's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, has said the order to leave is only temporary, with protesters allowed to return once the park has been cleaned, on the condition they don't bring items such as tents and tarpaulins. It follows similar evictions around the country. Police on Monday moved into an encampment in Oakland in California, while in Portland in Oregon, they confronted an estimated 1,000 protesters on Sunday.
Rapidly becoming a topic of conversation around the water cooler. The humble water storage device itself could soon be making the transition from the office to the battlefield. In case you're skeptical, watch this. BCB Internationals developed the Wall Breaker, a rather bizarre cannon that fires out water bottles at high speed to break through walls and vehicles. As you can see, it can do some pretty serious damage. The pneumatic device catapults water cooler bottles at a pretty nifty 300 feet per second. The company's already exporting the cannon to military and security forces around the world.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy.
Enough of them are scream and shout whenever I rap on the microphone. Cause I know how to write the rhythm, know how to roll like a pro. Some call me JFK and some of them call me Metro. I got the sound that'll move your body, sound that'll make your body go. Sound that'll make you move, I said now sound that'll make you sweat. Sound of the Metro beat now coming in live and direct. Spirits are massive, said you'll never forget. We got the heavyweight sound and that is no argument. When we play for the girls and the boys, they end up at them and make a whole heap of noise. When I got the mic and I shut up with my voice, everybody knew me at the people's choice. Man, I'm dance hollers in the dark party. Listen, I'm seeing the young at the top celebrity.
F. Kennedy has finally revealed the truth behind his death in 1963. Speaking at a press conference yesterday, the late American president revealed that he had actually committed suicide.
I had a tiny pistol which I had gotten specially made and which I then concealed in my mouth. And at the prescribed time, when the car was level with the book depository, I pulled the trigger with my tongue.
Mr. Kennedy went on to apologize to his wife and family for the years of anguish and called the man accused of his assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald, a true American hero. What
Edward George Ruddy died today. Edward George Ruddy was the chairman of the board of the Union Broadcasting Systems, and he died at 11 o'clock this morning of a heart condition, and woe is us. We're in a lot of trouble.
So, a rich little man with white hair died. What has that got to do with the price of rice, right? And why is that woe to us? Because you people and 62 million other Americans are listening to me right now. Because less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And that's why woe is us that Edward George Ruddy died. Because this company is now in the hands of CCA, the Communication Corporation of America. There's a new chairman of the board, a man called Frank Hackett, sitting in Mr. Ruddy's office on the 20th floor. And when the 12th largest company in the world controls the most awesome goddamn propaganda force in the whole godless world, who knows what fish will be peddled for truth on this network. So you listen to me. Listen to me. Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. But man, you're never going to get any truth from us. We'll tell you anything you want to hear. We lie like hell. We'll tell you that Kojak always gets the killer and that nobody ever gets cancer in Archie Bunker's house. And no matter how much trouble the hero is in, don't worry, just look at your watch. At the end of the hour, he's going to win. We'll tell you any fish you want to hear. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You eat like the tube. You raise your children like the tube. You even think like the tube. This is mass madness, you maniacs. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of the sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
Arawak men and women, naked, tawny, and full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the island's beaches and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore, carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, and gifts. He later wrote of this in his log. This is Columbus now, from his log. They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms, and they do not know them, for I showed them a sword, and they took it by its edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. These Arawaks of the Bahama Islands were very much like Indians on the mainland, who were remarkable, European observers were to say again and again, for their hospitality, their belief in sharing. These traits did not stand out in the Europe of the Renaissance, dominated as it was by the religion of popes, the governments of kings, the frenzy for money that marked Western civilization, and the first messenger to the Americas, Christopher Columbus. Columbus wrote, "As soon as I arrived in the Indies, on the first island which I found, I took some of the natives by force, in order that they might learn and give me information of whatever there is in these parts." The information that Columbus wanted most, where is the gold? He had persuaded the king and queen of Spain to finance an expedition to the lands. The wealth he expected would be on the other side of the Atlantic, the Indies, and Asia, gold and spices. For, like other informed people of his time, he knew the world was round, and he could sail west in order to get to the Far East. Spain was recently unified, one of the new modern nation-states, like France, England, and Portugal. Its population, mostly poor peasants, worked for the nobility, who were 2% of the population and owned 95% of the land. Spain had tied itself to the Catholic Church, expelled all the Jews, driven out the Moors. Like other states of the modern world, Spain sought gold, which was becoming the new mark of wealth, more useful than land because it could buy anything. There was gold in Asia, it was thought, and certainly silks and spices, for Marco Polo and others had brought back marvelous things from their overland expeditions centuries before. Now that the Turks had conquered Constantinople in the eastern Mediterranean and controlled the land routes to Asia, a sea route was needed. Portuguese sailors were working their way around the southern tip of Africa. Spain decided to gamble on a long sail across an unknown ocean. In return for bringing back gold and spices, they promised Columbus 10% of the profits, governorship over newfound lands, and the fame that would go with the new title, Admiral of the Ocean Sea. He was a merchant's clerk from the Italian city of Genoa, part-time weaver, expert sailor. He set out with 3 sailing ships, the largest of which was the Santa Maria, perhaps 100 feet long, with 39 crew members. Columbus would never have made it to Asia, which was thousands of miles farther away than he had calculated, imagining a much smaller world. He would have been doomed by that great expanse of sea, but he was lucky. One-fourth of the way there, he came upon an unknown, uncharted land that lay between Europe and Asia, the Americas. It was early October, 1492, and 33 days since he and his crew had left the Canary Islands off the Atlantic coast of Africa. Now they saw branches and sticks floating in the water. They saw flocks of birds. These were the signs of lands, of land. Then, on October 12th, a sailor called Rodrigo saw the early morning moon shining on white sands and cried out. It was an island in the Bahamas, the Caribbean Sea. The first man to sight land was supposed to get a yearly pension of 10,000 maravedis for life, but Rodrigo never got it. Columbus claimed he had seen the light of the evening before, and he got the reward. So approaching land, they were met by Arawak Indians, who swam out to greet them. The Arawaks lived in village communes, had developed an agriculture of corn, yams, and cassava. They could spin and weave, but they had no horses or work animals. They had no iron, but they wore tiny gold ornaments in their ears. This was to have enormous consequences. It led Columbus to take some of them aboard ship as prisoners because he insisted that they guide him to the source of gold. He then sailed to what is now Cuba, then to Hispaniola. There, bits of visible gold in the rivers, a gold mask presented to Columbus by a local Indian chief, led to wild visions of gold fields. On Hispaniola, out of timbers from the Santa Maria, which had run aground, Columbus built a fort, the first European military base in the Western Hemisphere. He called it Navidad, and left 39 crew members there, with instructions to find and store the gold. He took more Indian prisoners and put them aboard his 2 remaining ships. At one part of the island, he got into a fight with Indians who refused to trade as many bows and arrows as he and his men wanted. 2 were run through with swords and bled to death. Then the Niña and the Pinta set sail for the Azores in Spain. When the weather turned cold, the Indian prisoners began to die. Columbus's report to the court in Madrid was extravagant. He insisted he had reached Asia, it was Cuba, and an island off the coast of China, Hispaniola. His descriptions were part fact, part fiction. Columbus said, "Hispaniola is a miracle. Mountains and hills, plains and pastures are both fertile and beautiful. The harbors are unbelievably good, and there are many wide rivers of which the majority contain gold. There are many spices and great mines of gold and other metals." The Indians, Columbus reported, are so naive and so free with their possessions that no one who has not witnessed them would believe it. When you ask for something they have, they never say no. To the contrary, they offer to share with anyone. He concluded his report by asking for a little help from their majesties, and in return he would bring them from his next voyage as much gold as they need, and as many slaves as they ask. He was full of religious talk. "Thus the eternal God our Lord gives victory to those who follow his way over apparent impossibilities." Because of Columbus's exaggerated report and promises, his second expedition was given 17 ships and more than 1,200 men. The aim was clear: slaves and gold. They went from island to island in the Caribbean, taking Indians as captives, but as word spread of the Europeans' intent, they found more and more empty villages. On Haiti, they found that the sailors left behind at Fort Navidad had been killed in a battle with the Indians. After they had roamed the island in gangs, looking for gold, taking women and children as slaves for sex and labor. Now, from his base on Haiti, Columbus sent expedition after expedition into the interior. They found no gold. They had to fill up their ships returning to Spain with some kind of dividend. In the year 1495, they went on a great slave raid, rounded up 1,500 Arawak men, women, and children, put them in pens guarded by Spaniards and dogs, then picked 500 of the best specimens to load onto ships. Of those 500, 200 died en route. The rest arrived alive in Spain and were put up for sale by the archdeacon of the town, who reported that although the slaves were naked as the day they were born, they showed no more embarrassment than animals. Columbus later wrote, "Let us, in the name of the Holy Trinity, go on sending all the slaves that can be sold." But too many of the slaves died in captivity. So Columbus, desperate to pay back dividends to those who had invested, had made good his promise to fill the ships with gold. In the province of Sicao on Haiti, where he and his men imagined huge gold fields to exist, they ordered all persons 14 years or older to collect a certain quantity of gold every 3 months. When they brought it, they were given copper tokens to hang around their necks. Indians found without copper tokens had their hands cut off and bled to death. The Indians had been given an impossible task. The only gold around was bits of dust garnered from the streams. So they fled, were hunted down with dogs, and were killed. Trying to put together an army of resistance, the Arawaks faced Spaniards who had armor, muskets, swords, and horses. When Spaniards took prisoners, they hanged them or burned them to death. Among the Arawaks, mass suicides began with cassava poison. Infants were killed to save them from the Spaniards. In 2 years, through murder, mutilation, or suicide, half of the 250,000 Indians on Haiti were dead. When it became clear that there was no gold left, the Indians were taken as slave labor on huge estates, known later as encomiendas. They were worked at a ferocious pace and died by the thousands. By the year 1515, there were perhaps 50,000 Indians left. By 1550, there were 500. A report of the year 1650 shows that none of the original Arawaks or their descendants left on the island. The chief source, and on many other matters, the only source of information about what happened on the islands after Columbus came, is Bartolomé de las Casas, who was a young priest, and he participated in the conquest of Cuba. For a time, he owned a plantation on which Indian slaves worked. But he gave up that and became a very vehement critic of Spanish cruelty. Las Casas transcribes Columbus's journal, and in his 50s began a multi-volume history of the Indies. In it, he describes the Indians. "They are agile," he says, "and can swim for long distances, especially the women. They are not completely peaceful because they do battle from time to time with other tribes. But their casualties seem small, and they fight when they are individually moved to do so because of some grievance, not on the orders of captains or kings." Women in Indian society were treated so well as to startle the Spaniards. Las Casas describes sex relations. Marriage laws are non-existent. Men and women alike choose their mates and leave them as they please, without offense, jealousy, or anger. They multiply in great abundance. Pregnant women work to the last minute and give birth almost painlessly. Up the next day, they bathe in the river and are as clean and as healthy as before giving birth. If they tire of their men, they give themselves abortions with herbs that force stillbirths, covering their shameful parts with leaves or cotton cloth. Although, on the whole, Indian men and women look upon total nakedness with as much casualness as we look upon a man's head or at his hands. The Indians, Las Casas says, have no religion, at least no temples. They live in large communal bell-shaped buildings, housing up to 600 people at one time, made of very strong wood and roofed with palm leaves. They prize bird feathers of various colors, beads made of fish bones, green and white stones with which they adorn their ears and lips, but have no value on gold or other precious things. They lack all manner of commerce, neither buying nor selling, and rely exclusively on their natural environment for maintenance. They are extremely generous with their possessions, and by the same token, covet possessions of their friends and expect the same degree of liberality. In the book two of his History of the Indies, Las Casas, who at first urged replacing Indians by black slaves, thinking they were stronger and would survive, but later relented when he saw the effects on blacks, tells about the treatment of Indians by the Spaniards. It is a unique account and deserves to be quoted at length. Endless testimonies prove the mild and pacific temperament of the natives, but our work was to exasperate, ravage, kill, mangle, and destroy. Small wonder, then, if they tried to kill one of us now and then. The admiral, it is true, was blind as those who came after him, and he was so anxious to please the king that he committed irreparable crimes against the Indians. Las Casas tells how the Spaniards grew more conceited every day, and after a while refused to walk any distance. They rode the backs of the Indians if they were in a hurry, or were carried on hammocks by Indians running in relays. In this case, they also had Indians carry large leaves to shade them from the sun, and others to fan them with goose wings. Total control led to total cruelty. The Spaniards thought nothing of knifing Indians by tens and twenties, and of cutting slices off them to test the sharpness of their blades. Las Casas tells how two of these so-called Christians met two Indian boys one day, each carrying a parrot. They took the parrots for fun and beheaded the boys. The Indians' attempts to defend themselves failed, and when they ran off into the hills, they were found and killed. So, Las Casas reports, they suffered and died in the mines and the labors of the desperate silence, knowing not a soul in the world to whom they could turn for help. He describes their work in the mines. The mountains are stripped from top to bottom, to top, 1,000 times. They dig, split rocks, move stones, and carry dirt on their backs to wash it in the rivers, while those who wash gold stay in the water all the time with their backs bent so constantly it breaks them. And when the water invades the mines, the most arduous task of all is to dry the mines by scooping up pans full of water and throwing it up outside. After each 6 or 8 months of work in the mines, which was the time required of each crew to dig enough gold for melting, up to a third of the men died. While the men were sent many miles away to the mines, the wives remained to work the soil, forced into the excruciating job of digging and making thousands of hills for cassava plants. Thus husbands and wives were together only once 8 or 10 months, and when they were so exhausted and depressed on both sides that they ceased to procreate. As for the newly born, they died early because their mothers, overworked and famished, had no milk to nurse them, and for this reason, while I was in Cuba, 7,000 children died in 3 months. Some mothers even drowned their babies from sheer desperation. In this way, husbands died in the mines, wives died at work, and children died from lack of milk. And in short time, this land, which was so great, so powerful and fertile, was depopulated. My eyes have seen these acts so foreign to human nature, and now I tremble as I write. When he arrived on Hispaniola in 1508, Las Casas says there were 60,000 people living on this island, including the Indians. So that from 1494 to 1508, over 3 million people had perished from war, slavery, and the mines. Who in future generations will believe this? I myself writing it as a knowledgeable eyewitness can hardly believe it. Thus began the history, 500 years ago, of the European invasion of the Indian settlements in the Americas. That beginning, which you, when you read Las Casas, even if his figures are exaggerations, were there 3 million Indians to begin with, as he says, or less than a million, as some historians have calculated, or 8 million, as others now believe, is conquest, slavery, and death. When we read this book, history, when we read history books given to children in the United States, it all starts with the heroic adventure, there is no bloodshed, and Columbus Day is a celebration. Past the elementary and high schools, there are only occasional hints of something else. Samuel Eliot Morison, the Harvard historian, was the most distinguished writer on Columbus, the author of a multi-volume biography, and was himself a sailor who retraced Columbus's route across the Atlantic. In his popular book, Christopher Columbus, Mariner, written in 1954, he tells about the enslavement and the killing. The cruel policy initiated by Columbus and pursued by his successors resulted in a complete genocide. That is on one page, buried halfway into the telling of a grand romance. In the book's last paragraph, Morison sums up his view of Columbus. He had his defaults, he had his defects, but they were largely the defects of the qualities that made him a great, indomitable will, his superb faith in God and his own mission as the Christ-bearer to the lands beyond the seas, his stubborn persistence despite neglect, poverty, and discouragement. There was no flaw, no dark side to the most outstanding and essential of his qualities, his seamanship. One can lie about the past, or one can omit facts which might lead to an unacceptable conclusion. Morison does neither. He refuses to lie about Columbus. He does not omit the story of mass murder. Indeed, he describes it with the harshest word one can use, genocide. But he does something else. He mentions the truth quickly and then goes on to other things more important to him. Outright lying or quiet omission takes the risk of discovery, which, when made, might arouse the reader to rebel against the writer. To state the facts, however, and then to bury them in the mass of other information, is to say to the reader with a certain infectious calm, yes, mass murder took place, but it's not important. It should weigh very little in our final judgments. It should affect very little what we do in the world. It is not that the historian can avoid emphasis of some facts and not of others. This is as natural to him as it is to the mapmaker, who, in order to produce a usable drawing for practical purposes, must first flatten and distort the shape of the earth, then choose out the bewildering mass of geographic information, those things needed for the purpose of this or that particular map. My argument cannot be as against selection, simplification, emphasis, which are inevitable for both the cartographers and historians. But the mapmaker's distortion is a technical necessity for a common purpose shared by all people who need maps. The historian's distortion is more than technical. It is ideological. It is released into a world of contending interests, where any chosen emphasis supports, whether the historian means to or not, some kind of interest, whether economic or political or racial or national or sexual. Furthermore, this ideological interest is not openly expressed in the way a mapmaker's technical interest is obvious. No, it's presented as if all readers of history and a common interest which historians serve to the best of their ability. This is not intentional deception. The historian has been trained in a society in which education and knowledge are put forward as technical problems of excellence and not as tools for contending social classes, races, and nations. To emphasize the heroism of Columbus and his successors as navigators and discoverers, and to de-emphasize their genocide, is not a technical necessity, but an ideological choice. It serves unwittingly to justify what was done. My point is not that we must, in telling a story, accuse, judge, condemn Columbus in absentia. It is too late for that. It would be a useless scholarly exercise in morality. But the easy acceptance of atrocities as deplorable but necessary for the price you pay for progress, from Hiroshima and Vietnam to save Western civilization, Kronstadt in Hungary to save socialism, nuclear proliferation to save us all. That is still with us. One reason these atrocities are still with us is that we have learned to bury them in a mass of other facts. As radioactive wastes are buried in containers in the earth, we have learned to give them exactly the same proportion of attention that teachers and writers often give them in the most respectable of classrooms and textbooks. This learned sense of moral proportion, coming from the apparent objectivity of the scholar, is accepted more easily than when it comes from politicians at press conferences. It is therefore more deadly. The treatment of heroes and their victims, the quiet acceptance of conquest and murder in the name of progress, is only one aspect of a certain approach to history, in which the past is told from a point of view from governments, conquerors, diplomats, and leaders. It is as if they were like Columbus, deserve universal acceptance, as if the founding fathers, Jackson, Lincoln, Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, the leading members of Congress, the famous justices of the Supreme Court, represent the nation as a whole. The pretense is that there really is such a thing as the United States, subject to occasional conflicts and quarrels, but fundamentally a community of people with common interests. It is as if there is really a national interest represented in the Constitution, in territorial expansion, in the laws passed by Congress, the decision of the courts, the development of capitalism, the culture of education and mass media. History is the memory of states, wrote Henry Kissinger in his first book, A World Restored, in which he proceeded to tell the history of the 19th century Europe from the viewpoint of the leaders of Austria and England, ignoring the millions who suffered those statesmen's policies. From his standpoint, the peace that Europe before the French Revolution was restored by diplomacy of a few national leaders, but for factory workers in England, farmers in France, colored people in Asia and Africa, women and children everywhere except in the upper classes, it was a world of conquest, violence, hunger, exploitation, a world not restored but disintegrated. My viewpoint in telling the history of the United States is different, that we must not accept the memory of states as our own. Nations are not communities and never have been. The history of any country, presented as the history of a family, conceals fierce conflicts of interest between conquerors conquered, conquerors and the conquered, masters and slaves, capitalists and workers, dominators and the dominated, and race and sex. And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, it's the job of thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, not to be on the side of the executioners. Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides, which comes from the selection and emphasis in history, I prefer to try to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution from the standpoint of the slaves, of Andrew Jackson as seen by the Cherokees, of the Civil War as seen by the New York Irish, of the Mexican War as seen by the deserting soldier of Winfield Scott's army, of the rise of the industrialism as seen by young women in the Lowell textile mills, of the Spanish-American War as seen by the Cubans, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by the black soldiers on Luzon, the Gilded Age as seen by Southern farmers, the First World War as seen by socialists, the Second World War as seen by pacifists, the New Deal as seen by blacks in Harlem, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others. My point is not to grieve for the victims and denounce the executioners. Those tears, that anger, cast into the past, deplete our moral energy for the present. And the lines are not always clear. In the long run, the oppressor is also a victim. In the short run, and so far, human history has consisted only of short runs, the victims themselves, desperate and tainted with the culture that oppresses them, turn on other victims. Still, understanding the complexities, this book will be skeptical of governments and their attempts, through politics and culture, to ensnare ordinary people in a giant web of nationhood pretending to be a common interest. I will try not to overlook the cruelties that victims inflict upon another as they are jammed together into boxcars of the system. I don't want to romanticize them, but I do remember a statement I once read. The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is. I don't want to invent victories for people's movements, but to think that history writing must simply aim to recapitulate the failures that dominate the past is to make historians collaborators in an endless cycle of defeat. If history is to be creative, to anticipate a possible future without denying the past, it should, I believe, emphasize new possibilities by disclosing those hidden episodes of the past when even in brief flashes people showed their ability to resist, to join together, occasionally to win. I am supposing, or perhaps hoping, that our future may be found in the past fugitive moments of compassion rather than in its solid centuries of warfare. That being as blunt as I can is my approach to the history of the United States. The reader may as well know this before going on. What Columbus did to the Arawaks of the Bahamas, Cortez did to the Aztecs of Mexico, Pizarro to the Incas of Peru, the English settlers of Virginia and Massachusetts to the Powhatans and the Picos. The Aztec civilization of Mexico came out of the heritage of Mayan, Zapotec, and Toltec cultures. It built enormous constructions from stone tools and human labor, developing a writing system and a priesthood. It also engaged in the ritual killing of thousands of people as sacrifices to gods. The cruelty of the Aztecs, however, did not erase a certain innocence. And when a Spanish armada appeared at Veracruz, a bearded white man came to shore with strange beasts clad in iron. It was thought that he was a legendary Aztec god-man who had died 300 years before with the promise to return with the mysterious Quetzalcoatl, and so they welcomed him with munificent hospitality. That was Hernando Cortez. He had come from Spain with an expedition financed by merchants and landowners and blessed by the deputies of God, with one obsessive goal, to find gold. In the mind of Montezuma, the king of the Aztecs, there must have been a certain doubt about whether Cortez was indeed Quetzalcoatl, because he sent 100 runners to Cortez, bearing enormous treasures, gold and silver wrought into objects of fantastic beauty, but at the same time begging him to go back. Cortez then began his march of death from town to town, using deception, turning Aztec against Aztec, killing with the kind of deliberateness that accompanies a strategy to paralyze the will of a population by a sudden frightful deed. And so, in Cholula, he invited the headman of the Cholula nation to the square, and when they came, with thousands of unarmed retainers, Cortez's small army of Spaniards, posted around the square with cannon, armed with crossbows, mounted on horses, massacred them, down to the last man. Then they looted the city and moved on. When their cavalcade of murder was over, they were in Mexico City. Montezuma was dead, and the Aztec civilization, shattered, was in the hands of the Spaniards. All this is told in the Spaniards' own accounts. In Peru, that other Spanish conquistador, Pizarro, used the same tactics, and for the same reasons. The frenzy in the early capitalist states of Europe for gold, for slaves, for products of the soil, to pay the bondholders and the stockholders of the expeditions, to finance the monarchical bureaucracies rising in Europe, to spur the growth of the new money economy rising out of feudalism, to participate in what Karl Marx would later call the primitive accumulation of capital. These were the violent beginnings of an intricate system of technology, business, politics, and culture that would dominate the world for the next 5 centuries.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
They want to hit a Thanksgiving song! This is a Thanksgiving song. I hope you enjoy it.
Eat turkey. Love to eat turkey. Oh, I love you. Love to eat turkey, cause it's good. Love to eat turkey like a good boy should, cause it's turkey to eat. So good. That clapping's messing my head up, man.
I appreciate it. But I was trying to think of the next line. I'm like, all I hear is clapping. Here we go. Thanks anyways. Turkey for me. Turkey for you. Let's eat the turkey in my big brown shoe. Love to eat the turkey at the table. I once saw a movie with Betty Grable. Eat that turkey all night long. 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. Turkey lurkey do and turkey lurkey dap. I eat that turkey, then I take a nap. Thanksgiving is a special night. Jimmy Walker used to say dynamite. That's right. Turkey with gravy and cranberry. Can't believe the Mets traded that old strawberry. Turkey for you and turkey for me. Can't believe Tyson gave that girl BD. White meat, dark meat, you just can't lose. I fell off my moped and I got a bruise. Turkey in the oven and the buns in the toaster. I'll never take down my Cheryl Teague's poster. Wrap the turkey up in aluminum foil. My brother likes to masturbate with baby oil. Turkey and sweet potato pie. Sammy Davis Jr. only had one eye. Turkey for the girls and turkey for the boys. My favorite kind of pants are corduroys. Gobble, gobble, goo, and gobble, gobble, giggle. I wish turkey only cost a nickel. Oh, I love turkey on Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Now, go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.